Hey team, welcome back to another episode of the Student Paramedic Podcast. Hey team, welcome back to another episode of the Student Paramedic Podcast. My name's Alex, I'm your host today, and I'm joined today with Corey.
Hey guys.
And we're also sitting down with Scott Devanish and Douglas Prester, who are going to chat today a bit about the American experience and how Aussie students can go over there and experience that. So Scott, would you like to introduce yourself first?
I'm Scott. I'm the discipline lead of the paramedic science program at QUT. I've been a paramedic for 23 years.
Very nice. And Doug?
I'm the director of the paramedic program at Central Washington University in Washington State. And my history, I've been a medic for about 20-some years. I'm also a physician and a surgeon, and been that since 1997, so too long.
We thought we'd get you on today because Corey did his episode back in, I think it's episode 3 now, about his experience over in America. So we thought we'd get you guys on to have a bit of a chat about that in a bit more depth. So what do you guys do and offer for students that want to go and experience what the American service is like?
I guess, first of all, it might be good to sort of chat about how it all came about. And we've had a short-term mobility sort of a placement with quite a few countries now, Canada, UK, Vanuatu, New Zealand. And I got an email from Doug saying, hey, would you be interested in collaborating with us in the United States? And I thought, yeah, that'd be great. So it all sort of started from there, it started negotiation and numbers because, you know, you got like various funding models at university that will give students a certain amount of money, but you need a certain amount of students to do that. So we've got a minimum of 4 for us, but I think Doug had a higher number. So a bit of negotiation went around, the exchange numbers and how long it's going to be and what sort of activities we're going to form part of that. And I know from our perspective, Doug managed to get a lot more write out related stuff in the States than we could here because, you know, and I'll let Doug talk a bit more about the system over there, but each county has their own ambulance service. So there's so many more providers over there, whereas Queensland, there's only one ambulance service. And because the vast number of students here, we're sort of limited in relation to placement blocks and where we can put students. So we looked at the hiring model for the guys from the States because, again, they're equivalent to our critical care paramedics. So putting them out on an ACP truck would have been good for them, but I don't think it would have been as challenging as less of the Haru. So really what we did is we organised a couple of Haru ride-outs and then, you know, did some cultural stuff like Australia Zoo and Byron Bay and Gold Coast. And where else did we go, Doug? I'm trying to remember.
We got to experience all that. Plus we got to go to White Island, the Royal Flying Physicians, a lot of just different experiences that you have down in Australia that we don't have up in the States. So a great mixture of seeing the education models and that too. It was a fantastic experience for our students and for myself.
And in Fraser Island, that was a highlight too. That was good fun. From our perspective, when we go, we send students overseas previously, we've sort of modeled it around a cultural experience, a university experience and a professional experience. So integrate with university students and also network with professional paramedics. So that was so 3 weeks, I think 2 weeks would have been too short. 4 weeks we would have been cost prohibitive. So 3 weeks I think was just a bit of a sweet spot and it worked quite well. But I'll let Doug talk a bit more about his side and how he managed to organize it for our 4 students.
Yeah. So for me, my daughters have done foreign exchange programs in different countries. And I was really just kind of jealous because through my university system in the pre-med and in my paramedic background, there were no foreign exchange students. There was no ability besides, I mean, we can go within the States, which has got some fantastic areas, but there was nothing set up. So that was kind of my passion, was to make sure that the paramedic students and even some of the pre-med students that are interested in this field had the ability to go out and have something within those aspects, because I think foreign exchange programs are fantastic for the students to get those different perspectives, not only to find out what the differences are, but find out how similar we are with a lot of things we do. So that was my drive. And fortunately, we had someone at Central Washington University who knew Dr. Devenish and set us up. And so that was kind of the passion and the drive for doing that. I think for us, as far as the States, sometimes we get a bad rap as far as things go. And I know that was kind of one of the big things with the four students instead of Corey coming up there was, you guys are seeing gunshots every day, you know, and kind of getting those backgrounds. So I think it was kind of a nice experience to see what we do, how we do things, and how different we are across the States. The area we did the study abroad exchange was up in Washington State, but we're completely different than our neighboring states as well of how we do things. So I think it was just kind of fun to show them kind of what we do, where we at experience level. And for me, it was a great education to see the difference between an ACP, a CCP, and a HARO and a LARA unit that we don't have those delineations up in Washington State.
That's awesome. Those are great opportunities that you're providing for students. So in 2019, that was the first time that you guys did the exchange. In a brief synopsis, starting with Doug, would you be able to explain the key differences in paramedics? Because you both got to experience each country with your students separately. So if you could just go into the differences that you noticed when you were in Australia, and then for Scott, when you were in the US, in terms of paramedic scope of practice, etc.
Yeah, so one of the things that we noticed was different was when you talk about a paramedic and ACP, that's about the equivalent of what our EMTs are. So a lot of the skills that are there, you're equivalent to an advanced EMT. And the difference is your CCPs are pretty much equivalent to what our paramedics are, our entry-level paramedics. There's some differences from state to state, but that's about that level. So when we graduate from Central Washington University, they would be equivalent to a CCP. The HARO units, though, had that ability to do between sphincothoracostomies and just blood products and a couple different procedures that we just don't have within our scope of practice. I also really liked the centralized system for Queensland. You all run under the same medical director, the same protocols, the same scope of practice, whereas within Spokane County, which is about the size of Brizzy, volume-wise, we have 12 different departments and 12 different sets of protocols and scopes of practices in a sense. One department can carry some medications, the other department carries a ton more. And so there's quite a bit of difference, and we don't have that same regulation and that same, I guess, experience. No matter where you go in Queensland, it's the same kind of rules. And here you can go across the street and have a sole different set of protocols.
I think from my perspective it fascinated me that everything's bigger. The ambulances are bigger. The moustaches are bigger. the food sizing. So, but yeah, the ambulances were quite large compared to ours. And the fire-based sort of side of things, I mean, here we have a separate fire brigade and ambulance, but over there it's very integrated, and even the integration changes between the services. So when we went to Harbourview, it was very similar to our model here, that the ambulances, although they were red ambulances with, you know, fire and medic on the side, it was very similar to what we have here. Whereas other counties, the EMTs would actually be on their fire truck and wouldn't transport the is it EMR? Is that AMR, the private ambulance with transport, whereas others would be a bit of a mixture that you could work on the fire truck one day but be on the ambulance the next, but the ambulance would respond and transport, and also they could make a decision whether they would actually call in the private ambulance to transport if it was a low acuity medical case, for example, as opposed to a trauma or a cardiac arrest or whatever. So there's no standardized system. Each county had their own. And what also fascinated me was going to small towns in sort of northern Washington state where you'd have an ambulance station. There'd be a training room in the ambulance station, and that's where they'd actually train their own paramedics. So whereas here in Australia, apart from New South Wales, where there's still a diploma, but the vast majority are graduates. But everywhere else in the country, you have to be a graduate to become a paramedic. But over there, it's very much unregulated, I suppose. It appeared to me that every ambulance station had a training room, but then you have the university system where, with Doug as a director, and it doesn't seem to be too many university programs over there. It's almost like where we were back in the 80s, that there wasn't a lot of standardization with training. So that I found that fascinating. And also from the degree point of view, that we have a 3-year degree in Australia, but they have in paramedics, but they had a 4-year degree in the States. And the degree in the States, from what I observed, it was you do things like maths and English literature and history, and then you do your professional component. Whereas our degree have service units, which is professionalism and communication and physics, etc. But then it's all very clinically focused. So that was a big difference I saw too. So scope-wise, yeah, look, the scope of practice, they do RSIs, they do, MICA in Victoria do RSI, but Queensland CCPs don't, unless you're on the Haru. So their scope of practice was significantly higher. But when you're looking at a paramedic trained in a training room in a station, you wonder at the underpinning education they're actually getting is very skills focused. I sort of got the idea. Whereas a university with Doug, they get all that knowledge behind it, similar to what we do. So yeah, very unregulated.
That's really interesting. And so going from that, system difference and a bit of that scope difference, how did you guys find, similar question, going to each country, how did you find the epidemiology? Because I know when Corey came back, he was explaining, that he was going to gunshot wounds or, firework explosions and things like that. So how did you guys find the different presentations that you went to in each country?
Well, I noticed they didn't have box jellyfish antivenom in their protocols. that was one funny thing. Your gunshot wounds, etc., and our students expect to see lots of them. But then on the other side of things, the students from the States were saying, "Hey, you're 20 and you're still alive. You haven't been bitten by a shark or killed by box jellyfish yet. You must be lucky." So it's this kind of real stigmatization of guns in the States and things that kill you in Australia. From the perspective of I probably just leave to Doug to see what they saw in Australia, because apart from cups of fireworks and gunshot wounds, I guess a lot of the work was very similar. But from the American perspective, did any of your students see snake bites and box jellyfish things and shark bites, Doug, by any chance?
No, they didn't see any of that. And again, that's the misconception we're always told from the States. When you go to Australia, everything's bred to kill you. So they were expecting and wanting to see everything that's going to kill you. And of course, it was always fun telling the students to watch out for the drop bears as we entered out there. So that was fun for us on that. But as far as the epidemiology, the presentations that we were seeing there, I guess one of the biggest things that stand out to me, now I didn't do any of the ride-alongs, but given from the students, was the way the ACPs, the higher unit, and the CCPs work together on multi-system trauma, and especially on high impact velocity from freeway injuries and that. And I had one student, Pete, who was on there, and he was just kind of amazed to see how they work together. And it was a gentleman involved in a high speed MVA accident. And he was in a PEA rhythm, so dead at that point. The Haro unit did the finger thoracostomy, said, yep, we're going to have Ross here in 2 minutes based on everything they did. And they did it. He was like amazed on how quickly he was impressed. He questions one of the ACPs asked, how was my placement on the pelvic sling? And for us, sometimes in the States, again, I'll go to what Scott was saying about the lack of regulation that we do kind of have, but they were like, yeah, nope, that was placed. You could actually have been a little bit high. And the interactions, I think, between the groups was impressive, and some of the skills that they can do, especially in those MVAs and the way they treat those is a lot different than we do. And I think we have a lot that we gained from learning that. So on our end of things, yeah, we obviously have more weapons than that. And so there is that chance of seeing gunshot wounds and that penetrating trauma. In fact, we had an amusing story. I think, Scott, you were there with me when the gentleman was escaping on a raft down away from stealing something at a local grocery store. And yeah, the police officer's like, well, why don't we just shoot him and then we can pick up his body down the road? It was in jest, you know, but that's kind of the thing we say is we're going to see more penetrating trauma depending on what cities you are here.
I didn't see one gun when I was over the whole time. I know the boys went out shooting at a shooting range, but I didn't see one firearm the whole time. So I was sort of expecting, the Wild West, but no. I guess from the guys that did a lot of their shifts at Ellensburg too, that there's a lot of, so Ellensburg is about 2 hours, Doug, about 2 hours from Seattle.
Yes.
Yeah. So you got Seattle on sort of to the left-hand side. You got Ellensburg in the middle and then Spokane right on the far right-hand side near the Idaho border. And the guys would do a lot of cases in Ellensburg, but then transport it through to Seattle, which is about a two-hour drive. So it'd be a lot of transports. They had, the fixed wing. So the guys went out with helicopters as well, which, again, we couldn't organise here in Australia. But they, I think fixed wing and rotary wing, they had some experience in that, which was, Doug's connections over there, which is amazing. But, yeah, so that was one thing that, just doing that two-hour transport to Harbourview Hospital, then coming back, that's 4 hours out of your shift. Oh, the other thing, too, is shift work. Like, they can do up to 96-hour shifts. I mean, what's with that? we do 10, 12-hour shifts, and they do, I suppose they do what, 96-hour shift and have a prolonged time off. They live at station. Do you want to just talk about that, Doug? Because that just amazed me how you can have up to 96 hours on shift.
Yeah, it does vary, and it's kind of up to each of the departments, and they kind of regulate it. When we're talking about the downtown Seattle, downtown Tacoma, the high-volume areas, we're typically on a rotating shift, 24 on, 48 off. For the shifts, a lot of departments I work, we're 48 on, 96 hours off. And we do have some departments that work 96-hour shifts and then have another 96 hours off in a row. So it just kind of varies from some of the departments. And again, the higher call volumes, a lot of our ambulance companies, they run two ambulances out of a main station, and the first ambulance is first out on everything on their first 24 hours, and on their second 24 hours, they're only on second out calls. So there's some variance to make sure of your call volume, but on the really high call volume stations where you're running 20 calls in a 24-hour shift, they try and limit that to a 24-hour area.
It was also like the TV programs where the firefighters actually make their like food at the station. They all get together and so I think Chris, one of the students, was helping making the dinner and getting in there. So have a different fridge for the different shifts, and it was just like TV in that respect.
The fire departments, we really do treat things like family, and that was one of the big difference that, as you mentioned, that our firefighters are a frontline EMS, and again, 85% of our calls are medical calls instead of fire calls. But we start off in the morning, going to the grocery store, grabbing food for the day. We share lunch, dinner, breakfast, everything together. And we eat, sleep, everything kind of together as a team, because that's how we work out in the field. So it really becomes very family oriented.
It's awesome. So just before, you mentioned that there's not many university programs in the US. Just briefly, Doug, would you be able to explain the path to becoming a paramedic in the United States? Is it EMT, or do you start in a diploma sort of situation? What's the go there?
Absolutely. So Yeah, that's one of the big things we're trying to change. Right now, you have to be in an EMT for at least a year before you can even apply to any paramedic program. And the idea behind that is getting you out in the field, understanding what our paramedics do, and making sure, because to get into our EMT class, there's no prerequisites. It can be anybody off the streets that's 18 years old. Once you've been out there in the field for a year, you've kind of seen, you kind of understand is, do I want to make this commitment? And that's what can get in. A lot of our paramedic programs, probably almost 96%, are not university-based. They're certificate programs. And basically, you go class just to become a paramedic. There's no educational degree or component to it. And they get certified to basically work as a paramedic, and then they can take tests within to become licensed in whatever state they happen to be in. So it's really unregulated in that aspect. Our main regulation is what's called the National Registry, the NREMT for EMTs and paramedics. And it is a national test that covers the entire United States. The problem being is there's some paramedics that don't do 12 leads and don't RSI. There's some that do a lot more than that. So the regulation is just not out there. We're trying to get a big push within our association in the states of paramedicine to have a bachelor's degree requirement by 2030. But right now there's only 6 programs in the United States that you can even get a bachelor's degree from. And we're one of those 6.
That's really interesting. I didn't know that that was a thing until I listened to, I think it's The Pragmatics. They're one of the podcasts from over in America, and they were mentioning that. So that's really interesting. Had no idea. So if a student over in Australia is thinking about applying to become a paramedic over in the US once they graduate, how do they go about that?
Yeah, so the first thing, obviously, outside of getting the work visas and getting that type of portion taken care of, it would be taking the national registry or taking a state test. Right now, out of the 50 states, only 38% of them require the national registry test. To go in. So a lot of students will go into areas where they can basically come in, they have to take a written test to show their standards, and they have to present their training to show what level or what experience they're up to. For most ACPs that are coming here, and the couple paramedics that I know that are from Australia, I don't know if Corey got to meet one that was down in Tacoma at Medic One or not, but they come in here and usually start as a EMT or an advanced EMT and have to go through a gap analysis, if you will, and get some additional training depending on the state they're at to get up to that level of that paramedicine. But we now have several Aussies who are working throughout multiple departments. And one of the, going back to differences, one of the big differences that I did see was the need for paramedics for us up here. We'll have several fire departments that will have postings for jobs looking for 3 to 6 medics, and they may only get one application because we are so short on medics. And in fact, our standard class of paramedics are typically about 19 to 22. So we have a huge need for those areas in there. So I know there's going to be trying to get some things to get people from other countries and even the experiences to get those requirements met over here. But that's kind of the areas, this national registries and the written test, and then the gap analysis to fit depending on the states.
I think if I can jump in there too, because a lot of services, you're dual trained, fire and ambulance. I think, you know, so the Australian university programs produce very well-rounded paramedic graduates, but we don't train you to be firefighters. So that would be another area you'd have to depending on the actual service you're working for over there, you have to so you know, when we talk about continuous professional development, we just have to focus on the medical side of things, whereas they've got to focus on fire and medical. So yeah, they've got to be proficient in both. Absolutely. So when we took them around to Roma Street Fire Station and showed them they got a tour by the firefighters there, they're talking about hose gauges and all sorts of stuff. It was just over my head, but because they were dual trained, they had to know both. So,
and Scott, do you know what it's like if an American student wants to apply over in Oz, or is it, do they just go through the same processes?
So there's A visa issue would be the way to, but a lot of Australian services won't take people without a degree. So even if you've got associate degree, I know some people do an associate degree over there, still that's kind of accepted at almost diploma level. So the reciprocity, I mean, with a degree from Central Washington, that'd be different. But again, you know, the American system doesn't recognise our degrees. Because only 3 years, so that they're although they're both degrees, there is, you know, some issues with recognition, but the visa be the main thing. And also because we've got quite a lot of university students across the country. The last time I saw about 9,300, they wouldn't be opening up international recruitment because there's no need. 15-20 years ago, they opened up a big international recruitment, especially in Queensland, to try and get poach people from overseas. But at the moment, they don't need to do that. So the visa would be the main thing, and then having to get your recognition of prior learning accepted by an AMLET service to whether it be a graduate entry, a qualified entry. You couldn't go through graduate entry, but so it depends on the service, but the visa is the big thing.
That's awesome. It's interesting that it's opposite in each country. You know, in Australia, we have a surplus of students, quite a big surplus. And then in the States, it's a deficit. So overseas opportunities definitely could be an option for any Australian students listening. Moving on from that, what are some of the benefits that you guys noticed that the students gained from doing an overseas experience? I know we're in the midst of COVID right now, but in the next year or two, these things could be available for our listeners. So what were some of the benefits that you guys noticed the most in your students that went?
I took four students over there, Corey being one of them, and they didn't know each other and they came back really good mates. So I think that was one aspect. Also seeing how a different system works and different culture and in some ways, and not to get in the politics of things, but you know, we've got Medicare in Australia, so everyone gets access to healthcare, whereas in the States it's very much a user pay. So you know, especially from my perspective, and I do understand that in Washington State, if someone can't pay, I think the Catholic Church charity steps in, but we have very much a safety net in our country of you know, public hospitals are free as long as, you know, for citizens with Medicare. So I think you start to you start to realize that you shouldn't take those kind of things for granted. You also have to work ahead a tip. That was foreign for a couple of the students, hadn't been overseas. So how much do you tip? And if you don't tip the right amount, do you offend the waiter? And so I think, I remember Doug saying, hey, there's an easy way to do it. You don't need to get your phone out and actually work out what 15% is. So, just tipping, just different, a different culture, although we're very similar, because after the Second World War, Australia was very Americanized. There's subtle differences, and also just a vast number of people as well. You just 360 odd million Americans compared to 26 billion of us, so we're really quite tiny. So culturally, like universities, although there's beautiful big campus, nice and spread out in a small country town. But for me, it was really the cultural aspects of I think what the guys took on board.
Yeah, for us, and I think it worked out both ways. It was kind of nice because I think for the four students you had come over here, they were riding with paramedics who had more experience and more abilities, so they got to learn a lot of things that are maybe above their scope. And it was the same for us because our students got to ride with the HARO units, their scope of practice was above ours. They had that direct interaction with the physician too. I think that's what they really got out of that, was that kind of experience. Now we of course brought, what would you call Alex, a Bogan with us? Is that what you refer to? No. We got that interaction, and I think what really came from it is a lot of the people in our group, since we are at the university, all fairly knew each other. We had a couple who didn't. Not only was the bonding there, but I mean, they've kept up with relations of people they've met down there. We've just got on Netflix the paramedic show, and so now we can see some of the HARO paramedics on there that they rode with. So I think that some of those LifeLog friends, and I think the same when the four of you came up here, some of the experiences they were able to get at the States, and the communications that they'll stay on, I think that's the beauty of it, is one, finding not only those differences, but making friendships that are going to stay connected. And the educational differences was fantastic, just to get those extra experiences.
And also the language. I think they were telling Doug that his boot was open, and Doug was going, "What? Your boot's open, Doug, your boot's open." "Well, what? Oh, your trunk." "Ah." So just there's those little nuances in language too. I remember Doug saying to me, "What does this word cheers mean, Scott?" "Oh, it means thanks." "Oh, okay." So just little subtleties. It was actually quite fun.
That's awesome. Sounds like a really good experience. And hopefully, you know, in the next year or so, if it does open up again, students can get on that.
Both being a part of the education of paramedics, and also have been or are still being paramedics yourselves, for each country, what does the future of paramedics look like in terms of education and, you know, scope of practice and things that are coming about?
For us, I think the big thing is getting a standardized education and getting the bachelor's degree as a recognized portion of the paramedicine. I think one of the things we see up here is we're not necessarily recognized as professionals, if you will, in the hospital environments. And I think the big thing that we're lacking is that degree to take us kind of that next level. So that's why there is a big push. And I think we're going to start seeing that. And hopefully by 2030 is kind of our goal, is to trying to get bachelor's degrees out there and increase our education and experience level on that aspect. So that's where I see us going. I would love to see, excuse me, a standardized level of care across the states, because we do have such a discrepancy from state to state. And it really comes from our educational level, whether it's done in a certified training program or whether it's actually done at a university institution. So hopefully we're going to be pushing towards that way. The other thing I would like to see is some different levels of care, a critical transport medic we have and a flight paramedic we have, but I'd love to see the states envelop and adopt some of the stuff that you do in Australia and same as they do in England, having these high acuity rescue paramedics that can basically be physicians in the street and have ability to take care of these multi-system traumas. And especially because we have so many rural areas that are underserved and we just don't have that ability. So I'm hoping that's our goal and that's what I'm pushing them to move forward to. And in fact, been talking with QUT about trying to push even a master's program out of Central Washington University to help even push the education even further.
That's awesome. So I do thank you both for coming on today. We're going to go through our last three questions. So we'll get you guys to respond to these individually. So the first one is, what has been your greatest mistake, or what's been your biggest mistake that's resulted in your greatest learning?
I don't know how this relates to the question, but and I don't know that I would call it a mistake. I started out as a paramedic. I felt that I didn't have as much education. I didn't have the things that I really wanted to do. So I went on to medical school, got into surgery, and that was my passion. As a resident, I was doing surgery every single day. If I could have been a professional resident, I would have stayed doing that. But I really loved the action, the doing, the getting out. I'm really a hands-on person. And when I got into my practice later, most of my time was in clinics. And almost rare of it was even into the surgery portion of it. I'd be doing surgery half day a week and I'd be seeing patients inside a room. And I'd be driving down the street and I'd see a fire truck go by and it just that passion missed. And so I kind of switched out of being a physician and moved back into the paramedicine and back to that education world. And I still work as a paramedic in the field because I think if I'm going to teach it, I've got to be doing it. And so I don't see going into become a physician was a mistake at all. Or an accident, if you will, even though it was trauma. I just found that I love action. I love doing it. And I think the biggest thing I've learned for it is you got to follow where your passion is. And my passion is out in the field. It's interaction. It's doing the most good I can do. And so that's kind of what I've gotten out for it. I'd rather be there, be the first person on someone's worst day and be able to intervene between life and death situations. And I'm not doing that when I'm sitting in an office.
Yeah, so after working for New South Wales Ambulance Service for many years, I was on road paramedic, and then started a master's in education. Next thing, found myself at the training school, and after being at the training school for six years as an educator, it's unlike the university system where you have distinct semesters, and you know, you have 2 30-week semesters, and then you've got time for research, etc. With an ambulance service training ed center, you just start in January, go all the way through to December, and without breaks. And after 6 years, I just needed a change, and I got a job with Qantas, funny enough, as a medical trainer for cabin crew. And after teaching intensive care paramedics with New South Wales Ambulance, for me that was a little bit disillusioned, that role, and it just confirmed in my mind that pre-hospital care or paramedicine was really my preferred choice. So by stepping away from that, it sort of gave me a bit of thinking time, and then I got a job at Charles Sturt University and started the PhD, and then came up to QUT. So again, we'll call it a mistake, but it just gave me a bit of clarity that, you know, when you get to that point after, you know, being an organisation 10, 11 years, you kind of think, is this really what I want to do? And just stepping out going, yeah, this is what I want to do, and then leaping back in. So if it hadn't been for that, I wouldn't have gone into academia, but I probably would have still stayed with an ambulance service.
That's awesome. The second question is, what is one piece of advice that you would give to a student, or that you would have given to yourself as a student when you were a student?
Be good to your mother and pay your rent on time. No, don't be hard on yourself. You're not an expert. It takes time. It takes time to become proficient. You know, when you look at that theory, you know, academic theory of Benner's, you know, novice to proficient, it takes time to get there. And a lot of students I see today, if they don't get a 7, they beat themselves up. And it's, you know, in my day, you know, 4s open doors, P's make degrees. But these days, I think the pressure is that significant that unless you get a 7, you think you failed. Well, you know, a 4 or a pass is a pass. It means you can continue. You know, 5 is good, 6 is excellent, 7 is outstanding. But so don't be too hard on yourself. It takes a while to become proficient. It doesn't happen overnight.
I agree on you there, and I teach my students the same kind of thing. If you don't miss an IB and you don't miss an intubation, you haven't been doing it long enough. So you're going to make mistakes along the way. You just try and minimize those mistakes. The biggest piece of advice that I pass on to all our students, and especially after they've graduated, is don't let this be the pinnacle of your learning. As soon as you come out in the street and you're a brand new paramedic, you are just that. You're just a brand new paramedic. Your learning is just beginning. Continue to do not only your local trainings, look into your state conferences, your international conferences, listen to podcasts. You guys have right now in this time access to so many different ways to get education models that we didn't have. If we didn't have a book in it, we didn't have access. Between the internet, podcasts, everything else, be learning those things, challenging yourself each day on those things. One of the big things I taught myself was I was not good at pediatrics when I came out. So I tried to make my weaknesses my strengths. And I just challenged myself, and I challenged my students every day to continue learning. And I find that I'm learning something still every day. Every lecture I go to, I can pick out at least one or two things I didn't know. And so that's the area I push is continue your education. Don't let it stop.
That's great. I really love that one. And the last one is, what did you used to believe to be true that you no longer believe to be true?
Oh, rotating tourniquets. No. There's been all sorts of things in the last 23 years that we were taught, and then they're no longer around. Like Hemosil, for example. Hemosil was talked about as this wonderful solution, but now you never see it. Mask suits was something else. You know, cricoid pressure. To you know, it may help you see the vocal cords, but it doesn't prevent vomiting. So it's you know, raising the legs in someone who's shocked. All these things you're taught along on the way, which evidence over time. You know, sitting someone legs dependent when they've got cardiogenic pulmonary edema. Where's the evidence for that? So all this, one of our academics said to us when we were doing my degree 20 odd years ago, they said, 30% of what we teach you is incorrect, but the problem is we don't know which 30%. So because things just change. So yeah, I've learned all sorts of things over the years, which some of them don't do anymore, which is probably a good thing.
Yeah, I agree. And I think especially for us, one of the big things we've seen is all the changes in cardiac arrest. The things that I believe to be true are going to be wrong even going forward. 1944, one of the physicians presented to the American Association of Cardiologists that we should be doing chest compressions only and not breathing. And he was laughed out of the area. And that's what we're doing today. And it's showing our resuscitations. I grew up in an area where we did high dose multi-epi. We did 1 milligram, 3 milligrams, 6 milligrams of epi. We could bring a board back to life with as much as we were shooting in there. And now we're finding out how dangerous epi can be, especially in cerebrovascular constriction. And I can maybe get the body to come back to life, but I'm not making the brain go dead. New revelations we're seeing with heads up CPR, which was invented solely because in Seoul, Korea, with all the tight spaces, they had to figure out if they carried the body on the stretcher head up or head down. And when they did it head up, they were actually getting higher survival rates. So there's so much that we don't know that our truths right now, 10 years from now, we're going to be doing things completely different. So I'm a student of learning, and I hold everything we hold now to believe is true could be changed down the road. And I'm always open to those as long as the science supports it.
That's awesome. Well, thank you guys so much for taking the time out of your day to have a chat to us. And hopefully our listeners have learned something about, you know, possibly even going over to America, experiencing those exchange programs and possibly even a career. Thanks for listening to this episode of the Student Paramedic Podcast. You can connect with us on Instagram, Facebook, Twitter, or you can email us at thestudentparamedicpodcast@gmail.com.